This is the Average Guy Network, and you have found Home Tech, show number 134, recorded on September 5th, 2013. Here at Home Tech, we cover all your favorite tech gadgets that find their way into your home, news, reviews, product updates, and conversation, all for the average tech guy. I'm your host, Jim Collison, broadcasting live from the AverageGuy.tv studios here in Bellevue, Nebraska, and we post the show with world-class show notes each week, and actually I've been adding some things to the show notes. So if you haven't checked them out over the last 2 weeks, you can now go into the show notes and click the link to the exact spot in the YouTube video for what we've talked about. So if you haven't checked those out, get out to the show notes, theaverageguy.tv. Like for this show, it'll be theaverageguy.tv/HT for Home Tech, HT 134, 133 for last week, 132. You get the pattern there, right? Head out and check out those show notes. I've been putting a bunch of time into them lately, so appreciate you guys reading those. If you have questions, comments, or contributions, you can contact the show via email. Just send that to me, podcast@theaverageguy.tv. Of course, find me on Twitter @JCollison, or follow the show schedule over on our Twitter account, The Average Guy TV. If you can also join us live for the show and for chat over at theaverageguy.tv/live when it works. It's having a little difficulty tonight, although it's working for Christian, not working for us. But typically you can head over there. We also have a high-def YouTube version. If you just look at the upper right-hand corner at theaverageguy.tv, you can click the link. And when I get it right, you can watch this on YouTube live in a high-def version. Get a little bit better video that way. You can watch it out there as well. All right, we've got a great show for you tonight. Christian's got a whole bunch of stuff to kind of update us on, so we're going to spend a little bit of time in an extended Christian's Corner, and so we'll roll that out here in a second. A couple housekeeping items just to get out of the way for you guys that are listening and come to the meetup. We, of course, we are finalizing the plans for the September 21st meetup in Indianapolis. Most of you, a lot of you that listen to this are coming, and if you, it's still not too late. We've got a handful of slots that are still open. We haven't filled it all the way yet, but it is. We are still getting folks that are signing up for it. So Mike is all set. Mike Howard is all set to come as well. Mike, you getting geared up for the meetup?
I am. I'm getting all geared up, ready to come.
And we're still trying to figure out a way to get Christian there, but I just think it's going to be too much of a distraction for him. He's busy with his freshman year school. Christian, how's school going?
School is amazing. It's exceeded my expectations so far in many different ways, and it's been an extremely hectic, busy, rushed week, but a lot of excitement, and it's really fun to be out here. So
nice. All right, good stuff. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that here shortly, but good to see you and good to have you in a new location, not the not where you live this summer, not home in Buffalo, but in your dorm room there. And so this will be the view we'll see from here on out, for at least for the rest of the year, maybe?
Yeah, I probably.
You have to kick your roommates out?
I mean, I could work on the visual appearances in the back, but yeah, no, I kicked the roommate. He didn't care, but I kicked him out anyway.
What did he say when you told him that you do a podcast every Thursday?
He kind of laughed, and then he was like, wait, really? and then I made him and then I made him follow the Facebook page and all that.
Nice.
So.
Oh, that was so that's your roommate.
Yeah.
Nice.
So
nice.
I might get some fellow Terps to start following the show. We'll see.
Yeah. We could be big on the campus there.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could be a superstar.
Sure.
A superstar. We were listening to that the other night. By the way, speaking of listening, we've changed our pre-show music offering. And so if you join us for the live show, we got a new way to do it. We used to illegally just broadcast whatever we wanted out across live stream, and we never did it on YouTube. So well, I should say never. Every once in a while, I'd sneak into YouTube and get shut down. We talked about that on a couple podcasts back, I think two back, 132. We talked about Mike getting banned on YouTube. And so, of course, whenever there's a problem like that, I immediately, the brain goes to work, and I thought, all right, what can we do where we can broadcast legally? And so I looked into a few different sites, and really the best one I found out there is called Groove Shark. If you haven't checked that out yet, GROOVESHARK, grooveshark.com. Create an account. You can go out there, and you can actually stream you for free on your browser. You can listen to any music that you want. They have the licenses for almost all the major music organizations, and so a lot of that music's available out there. You can actually upload your music to your music to their site as well, and I think they music match at that point. But lots of different options. The way we do it is you can actually create a broadcast channel. So if you go out to theaverageguy.tv/music, that is my broadcast channel. And you can head out there. And what we're going to do about an hour before the show, we'll jump in and I'll take requests on music. It's kind of fun. Mike and I messed with it. We did it for tonight's show, and it was five or six guys jumped out. Mike and I wasted about 3 hours on it the other night, right? We got together, and I was DJing, and he was adding music in, and we were talking about the music we liked. And it's a pretty cool, Mike. I mean, you think
it is a huge time suck, because you get in there, and you start remembering all these songs you want to play. And you just keep going and going and going, and you build up a list, and you don't want to leave until those songs are done. But before they're done, you think of other songs you want to listen to, and it just keeps going. You're right. We spent about 3 hours with that. Before we know it, you know, 3 hours are over.
Like, it was midnight. We're like, oh man, we got to go to bed. But you know, we picked up a couple listeners in the process as we were out there messing around, and then the next night you were testing it out, and I jumped on your station, and it's kind of fun. I mean, it's so. If you're gonna come out and listen to us live, you want to be a part of that, you don't necessarily have to create a Grooveshark account to pull that off. You can just listen, but they do have chat, and you can make suggestions into the DJ, which would be me. That would allow you to kind of influence the music. So let's have fun with it. Join us out 7 p.m. Central, so an hour before the show starts. 8 p.m. is when we start. Join us out there, Grooveshark.com. Actually, if you just go to theaverageguy.tv/music. And I'll have that in the show notes as well, but you can head out, and that's the station. From time to time, I think there's no reason not to, anytime you're listening to music, just to start broadcasting, right?
Yeah. And, you know, the other fun thing is if you have more than just the two of us in there, as one person makes suggestions, the other people can almost vote on it by, like, thumbs up in it, or I don't think you can thumbs down, but thumbs up in it, and it moves it up in the rankings, and then the broadcaster, or DJ, which is you, can choose to use one of those that are higher ranked.
Yeah, it's kind of like American Idol for the for music that's already done.
Yep.
So you choose the music, come out and join us Thursday nights. Another reason to come join us live. Lots of good stuff going on live. And I didn't finish on the meetup, but if you still want to head out, we are getting ready to do that. And a lot of folks are coming in for the meetup in Indianapolis. So get ready to do that. And then we've had some good luck with the Tech Scholarship Fund. So remember, I've been talking about that. I'll mention it towards the end of the show. But if you're interested in reviewing something for us, we have a little bit of a fund set up to buy you that thing that you want to review. We'll ship it to you. You review it either on the show or in a post form, and you get to keep it. It's pretty cool. We'll talk about that a little bit more.
Hey, Jim, the guy out there in chat wanted you to do something before we go any further. If you can run up on the roof and move your antenna a little bit to the left, your video is a little bit blurry.
I saw that. It was Tim. Although he said he took Dramamine with his beer. He's fine now. So I guess my picture's clearing up. Is you're still saying this? So just from a tech standpoint, we noticed now in the Hangout that if you have really good video, a little HD symbol shows up at the bottom right-hand corner of your... So, Mike, say something.
Something. Is mine still saying HD?
What'd you say? No, I'm just kidding.
It looked like a little earlier it went away, but yeah.
No, it's there. It's there now. Yeah. So Google continues to make really good improvements to these Google Hangout infrastructures. In fact, starting a couple new podcasts where I'm not in the podcast. I'm helping some folks start some podcasts. And we're just going straight to Google Plus and Google Hangouts on it. Some good stuff. Thanks, Google, for putting that stuff in there. All right, I have a bunch of stuff at the end of the show that we'll talk about, but we wanted to catch up with Christian a little bit. He's been doing some crazy things on the road and abroad and all those. No, I don't think abroad, but Christian, what do you got for us here in Christian's Corner?
Yeah, so a lot of stuff, and I'm just going to broadly label it stuff, has transpired since a couple weeks back when I hopped on. So, I don't really know where to start, but I guess I'll start with stuff. So, first on the plate, I'm now situation-wise on campus at Maryland, in case that somehow didn't get across the last time I mentioned it. It's really quite amazing how many people can show up on one particular sidewalk trying to get between a class from 12 to 1, and not only is everyone packed like sardines on the sidewalk, but then you have a bike, and you're switching between street and sidewalk and grass and mountaintops. And,
you sport a bike there?
It's the only way to get around campus.
Nice.
I can get from end to end to campus in like 5 minutes if I go downhill. It's about 7 or 8 if I'm going back uphill, but if you try and do it walking, some of my classes it would take over 20 minutes to walk to, and I only have 10 minute gap period between some of my classes, so I'm flying from one end to the other half the time. So Actually, believe it or not, my room is right by the stadium.
Really?
So whenever there's game night football, you can just sit right from your window and know who's winning.
Okay, so you just hear the crowd, right?
Yeah, and you also get the nice stadium lights flooding your room for the weekend. Classes have been really good. Pretty much everything has been smooth sailing, save for calculus, which at Maryland is all theory-based instead of application-based, which makes it much more trickier to follow. So it's kind of where my first priority is academically. And also the cybersecurity so far has been a lot of fun. And there's a lot of cool stuff going on. We have a AC's launch event September 25th, really high visibility. It's the official launch of the first cybersecurity program that I'm a member of with 57 other students in the Honors College at Maryland. And the president of the university, the chancellor of the university school system, the CEO of Northrop Grumman, Wes Bush, and a handful of other celebrities will be there in attendance. And they'll also be nominating one speaker from our class to participate in that. So really, there's just a lot of cool stuff going on with that program, and it's a good part to participate in. And in terms of where I'll be next week, I think I'll probably change the scenery up and do a broadcast from my office just to spice things up.
Where?
So,
Christian, what'd you say?
From my office.
From your office. All right. Good enough.
Yes. So that will be fun.
Where is your office at?
It's at SGT headquarters, which is in Greenbelt, Maryland. And in context of larger pictures, if you don't know Maryland geography too well, it's about 25 minutes outside of D.C. So if you think of D.C. right in the center, and then you draw a circle around D.C., on the bottom of that circle is Alexandria, Virginia. And the top of that circle, probably around 2 o'clock area, is where College Park is. And then in the center is D.C. So pretty much everything on that circle is linked into Union Station and the MARC trains. And I mean, whether you're on the top circle or the bottom circle, it's all federal stuff going on.
The D.C. Metro doesn't come out to you, does it?
Oh, yeah. Just hop on there's a College Park line from the MARC train that's like a mile from where I'm staying at, and you just take the MARC train and it goes straight into Union Station.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I lived in Northern Virginia there at Fort Belvoir for a while. We used to jump on the metro and take the metro into D.C. It was just really the only way to travel in D.C. It's such, the traffic's so bad.
Sure.
Yeah. Cool. Cool. So you're getting around. Are you driving?
Yeah.
You got your car there, or how are you getting to work?
Not yet. The car is a work in progress, as I like to label it. It's a WIP, which means that I'm primarily taking what's called Shuttle UM, which is a free bus service on campus that drops me off about 0.1 miles from the office. So it's not bad. It takes me probably around 25 to 30 minutes there and to get there one way, which isn't terrible, but what in reality it would be like a 10-minute drive with a car. But depending on what I do in the future, I'm going to need it anyway. So at some point I'll bite the bullet. It's just a question of when. And I'll probably be doing some work travel in my winter recess for NASA, so that'll also necessitate transportation requirements. So
yeah, you'll be a busy kid for sure. Hey, we're getting a little latency from you, so just don't be surprised if we walk over each other. So
yeah, I should have hardwired, but I didn't have time to.
You go on Wi-Fi. Yeah, no sweat.
Yeah.
We'll get it. We'll get you improved each week. We'll improve your quality.
Sure.
Yeah. So entertainment is a key there, right? For any college student, entertainment is the key, right? Finding the right ways to get entertainment. You have found a pretty good way to get all your entertainment ported right into your room there.
Yes. So, of course, everyone's ears are going to start tuning out if I say the application right up front, because we always talk about it. So I'm going to refrain from saying the application name and tell you what I've done so that you can get excited. And then when I say the application name and you go, wait, what? Then you can just quietly simmer and say, wow, that's actually pretty cool. So imagine if you could tune over 1,800 HD Fios television stations from your car, from your cell phone, from your desktop, from your laptop, or anything that has a browser and can connect to the internet. And the answer to that question is now you can, and not only can you do it once or twice, but you can do it up to 3 concurrent connections with the setup I have, and if you get the extended edition, up to 6. And what this is a combination of the HD Home Run Prime sitting on my home network being tied in directly to none other than everyone's favorite application on this show, Subsonic. So now I can stream HD Fios television straight to my dorm room. It's kind of pretty awesome because no one else gets these stations here, so they're all running to the lounge to get their Ravens games. If I'm going to SGT and I'm on the bus, I can pull up my news stations right on my Galaxy Note 2, and I can stream that in high definition or in standard quality. And even in high definition, where there's 350,000 IPs on the University of Maryland's network all fighting for bandwidth, I can stream without a single blip, a single graphics issue, a single sound garble, or any pause in my stream. So,
wait a minute. How do you know that there's that many IPs on that network?
That's for me to know and for you to think about.
I thought so.
they have general approximations of total devices on network. But once I'm formally vetted for the cybersecurity stuff, I'm going to have to start shutting my mouth on that more and more. That's publicly knowledgeable information. So,
okay, all right, just to make sure.
That one's clear. But actually, University of Maryland in and of itself is its own ISP, and I'm amazed at how good the internet connection is from wherever you are. I mean, you can walk anywhere on campus. There's Wi-Fi. You get a consistent 10 down on wired no matter where you are, which is pretty good when, like I said, there's 36,000 students alone hitting the network, not to count all the other servers and devices and faculty and so on and so forth. And apparently I've heard stories that when people get off the campus and it's like winter break, there's people hitting like 600 down to their dorm room who are still on campus because the QoS readjusts for the load. So, I mean, they have a huge T1 pipe coming in, and they're their own internet service provider. So, I mean, they're doing a real pro job at the network here, and it's pretty sophisticated. And there's a lot of third-party people that access the network that are affiliates of the university, too. So, really quite sophisticated. But, I mean, the fact that I can get HD Fios television from Buffalo, New York, streaming without a hitch, no matter where I am, is a really nice feature, especially because I don't have to set up Windows Media Center anymore. I don't have to configure tuners. Recorded TV, I just program at home, and then I can pull it in over VPN, so I don't really have to worry about doing that. But, I mean, come on, anything that has a browser and can go to a subsonic address, that's a pretty cool functionality to have. This project was first attempted back in 2011. There was like some mild success with it on Linux, but no one had gotten it working on Windows. And even with Linux, there was a lot of transcoding and streaming issues that, fortunately, because of one of the recent updates to the HD Home Run firmware and API, I was able to leverage one of the newer functionalities in the device to get it to work. So basically streams right into the JW player, which is what Subsonic runs on, and then FFmpeg does the transcoding behind the scenes, which is the native transcoder for Subsonic. But I mean, like I said, it's really fantastic to be able to queue up HD and put it on the big screen, and it's simple, and you don't even have to. It's just plug and play.
So, Christian, let me ask you this: is Subsonic a replacement for Media Center? I mean, we've had a lot of talk on the Facebook page. If you go out to theaverageguy.tv/Facebook, that's our Facebook group. We've had a lot of talk about the death of Media Center. We all know it's going away. I mean, realistically, can't for both internal and external use of your own media, including your own TV tuners. Is Subsonic a viable replacement for watching everything in the house? I mean, is there a player I can use that uses the Subsonic service inside to pull that media without having to have a PC set up?
I mean, I think it's kind of... All right, so let's start with some ground rules here. I think it's absolutely absurd that Microsoft is getting rid of Windows Media Center.
Absolutely.
I think it's absolutely absurd that they're going to let... Apple walk all over them with their Apple TV, and Apple's rolling this out full time, and Microsoft's like, oh, I don't know, let's pull out of the market. But in any case, that's probably another reason why there's a bit of an executive change at Microsoft happening.
Just a little bit.
But and that being said, I mean, there is always a, how should I put this? There's always a need for a media center application. And I think the problem people get mixed up with is what defines a media center application. And to me, it's not just the television. Like, yeah, I can do channels and stuff, but it's kind of like the whole thing. So think about how, you know, your standard Fios set-top box has live TV, video on demand, and recorded storage space, right? So, like, for example, in this subsonic solution, I get the live TV wherever I am, which is fantastic, and really cuts out of the picture, you know, oh, well, I don't have the, you know, I don't have the Windows Media Center DRM software installed on this and blah, blah, blah. You know, you just hit a play button and there it is, regardless of the device. That being said, I think a big component of what makes a media center is being able to record and archive and save TV. Obviously, I think that has become intermixed with kind of the video on demand services that cable companies provide, whereas before that stuff really became popular, just the idea that you could record live TV to a hard drive was revolutionary before we started, you know, streaming free television. And I think what has started to change that paradigm is you start to see a lot of like, for example, if you're looking at series television, if you go to something like USA Network and you play any of their, like, frontline episodes, right, new episodes, you just, at this point, you just type in your subscription account. So if you're a Verizon Fios customer, you type in your Fios account, and it validates you as being a paying TV customer, and then, yeah, you can watch all that stuff, and it's no big deal. They have the whole season up there. So I think a combination of those three kind of features of absorbing media is important, but really an all-inclusive media center shouldn't just include the television. It should include the music, the video, the, you know, the whole works. And I think Subsonic does a really good job of that, save for, in my solution, there's no recording TV functionality. Now, if I wanted to get really clever and creative, I could definitely do that, but it's, you know, a lot of programming I don't feel like doing.
So live is available, but recording is not.
Yeah, because for me, it's just as easy to schedule a recorded television through remote desktop and then sign out. Because, I mean, and not even that, but all the things that I want to record are on a schedule already. So the media center sets the recording already, dumps it on our network drive, and then it's available in Subsonic. So
right.
It's not like, so really, Subsonic does give you that recorded TV functionality. It's just you set your recording device on a schedule so that you're not doing the scheduling in Subsonic.
Yeah, and that's fair, right? You would log into the Subsonic control panel, whatever, right? Set
sure.
Those to record, they record to a folder, and then the viewing is done through the Subsonic player, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, I can watch any recorded TV that we record off Media Center or anywhere else on Subsonic. It just automatically, the place that Media Center dumps it to is the same place where Subsonic looks to pick it up, so it's really intuitive in that sense. So, I mean, Subsonic can really, is the most versatile in the sense that any device, mobile, desktop, is going to be able to play your content live or streamed with the solution I've implemented. But really, I think the notion that Media Center is dead is a crappy one, because there needs to be some kind of theater entertainment system still. And to be honest, for me, a web interface doesn't qualify as a theater system.
Yeah.
Right? So that, and like I said, if I just want to pull up a television station and watch from wherever, I'm definitely going with Subsonic. You know, why bother with Windows Media Center? But if I'm in a home environment where I got, you know, the 5.1 surround system and it's the 60-inch plasma and it's a dedicated computer running that box, you're damn right I want it to be Microsoft Windows Media Center, and I just want to hit the Windows Media Center remote control and go, you know, go watch television. So I think it's stupid that it's being phased out. I think you can clearly see Microsoft is indecisive about what they do, because you can still get it as an add-on for Windows 8 and 8.1, so why it's now this magical add-on to the operating system is also absurd. But look at all the open-source Media Center applications out there. XMBC continues to gain popularity on all sorts of devices. I've tested XMBC, and it can pick up all the HD Home Run tuners without a problem. There's Media Run. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff that's out there.
What about Plex?
Yeah, I have not had personal experience with Plex. I've actually seen some talk about, when I was doing some Home Run research, saw Plex come up into the discussion for integration with Home Run, but I don't really have enough experience with that software to make a comment other than that. If there's some amazing feature that has that something like Windows Media Center, which used to be out of the box, doesn't, then I don't really know what the adoption point is.
Plex just has a really nice interface. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, we have one computer on Windows 8 with Media Center on it, and it uses a whole house DVR, and then we have two of our three TVs have an Xbox 360 that we use as extenders for Media Center. And it works, you know, beautifully. Once you get it up, you can record from there. You can watch. You know, we have a large hard drive in there, so we can record a lot of shows, and we can do all that. Now they're talking about the Xbox One not being an extender. I'm probably going to buy another 360 and put it on our third TV because I was waiting for the One, but I think we're going to do that. I wonder why Microsoft didn't go with just adding one of the cable cards or whatever it is. Yeah, because I got the HD Home Run Prime, and that's how we're getting it on through the Xbox, and you put one of those cards in there. Why not just have that as an option in the Xbox 360? We just plug that thing in there, and bam, now you have that as your cable box.
Yeah, this might be somewhat of an uneducated answer, but my first thought would be that it would probably drive the price of the unit up significantly, because just think of the Home Run. It has a device to read that card. It has a decoding and decryption unit in it. And then the transcoding, yeah, Xbox should have that built in with its GPU. But I would imagine it would add some MSRP.
I think some of the problem with like the Prime is probably everybody who's watching the show has no problem setting it up or dealing with a cable company. But the average consumer, you know, the cable company guys are not all that smart. You know, every time I have a cable guy come out to the house, he comes and says something like, "Your TiVo not working?" I say, "No, TiVo's working fine. My internet's out." And every time they come to the house, they come for the wrong reason. I got to set them up right. So when I went to get my cable card for my HD Home Run Prime, I just went there and told them, I'm getting this for my... I went to the local store and told them I'm getting it for my TiVo. I didn't tell them anything about the Prime because they would have been all confused and not done it right. Just I'm getting it for my TiVo. I bring it home, then I set it up.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of what's made it difficult for Microsoft is these cable companies don't have much of incentive to do it, and then their customer support is horrible
sure.
for the average consumer.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, really, I'm kind of surprised that... I don't know. I guess for at least... thinking for Fios, probably one of the attraction points for them keeping people hooked on the set-top boxes is sucking in the money for video on demand, because there's a bunch of suckers who go on there and spend $5 a day on stuff that they can get a bunch of other places for a lot less money. So I imagine that's in an effort to try and keep it Verizon-branded stuff. To me, it would be interesting if they just went all, you know, they just started handing out those cable cards as your device, and then it was on the, just like it's on the consumer to, you know, go out and buy a computer, it's on the consumer to go out and buy their TV device, right? And then all the cable company is doing is providing you their encryption, whatever, right? So
it's going to be interesting how this changes, because I think the stranglehold that these cable companies have over us is going to be slowly whittled away.
Yeah, I imagine it will. I mean, we've seen a lot of the merging of TV and computer. I mean, that was pretty much well forecasted years ago. And I think the ultimate resolution of that will be when set-top boxes are no more. And that will mean that Verizon and other companies will have to change their strategy, because they're not. What they aren't going to do is let go of getting all that money from video demand.
Absolutely.
So they're
going
to find a way to. They're going to have to find a way to do it through like an online service or something. But whatever they come up with, they're going to have to find a way to do it through something other than a set-top box. And I'm sure that's doable. I mean, it's just a question of rethinking architecture. So.
Yeah.
You know, the transition won't be a smooth, easy one.
No,
they won't give up. They won't give up easily.
And it'll, you know, they got to find a way to make money. I mean, we like stuff for free, and that doesn't build infrastructure, you know, for companies. So we're going to have to give a little, get a little in the process. We're going to have to give up some of the, we still got to pay for it in some way. Although, I pay $75 a month for my internet, so it's not like the internet's free. I don't have a bandwidth cap, but it's not like the internet's free for me. So
yeah.
I don't know.
It's really... really what should start to transpire is that, here's a really bizarre idea, rather than having a TV bill and an internet bill, you just have an internet bill. And that internet bill includes television media services.
Yeah.
So you pay for your bandwidth, you pay for your speed, you pay for your media streaming services, and that's it. And the idea of television gets blown away.
Well, we already see that happening, right? We're in the early stages of both Amazon Prime Video and Netflix being very, very successful with just streaming video.
So, yeah, the caveat there being that they're not providing internet to you.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
And we also, one thing we got to get away with is these artificial caps that the cable companies and internet service providers make up, and they give you excuse. You know, sort of like the "we're doing this for your own protection" type. You know.
Yeah, those will crumble. I mean, look at the cable companies already know that their ship is sunk with the evolution of Fios. I mean, Fios has forced all these companies to bring up their bandwidth. I mean, it's unlimited on Fios. So any person who has Fios in their area and some cable company says, "Well, you only get 100 gigabytes of bandwidth a month," they're just going to say, "Yeah, see ya, Fios, plug it in." So, and I mean, look at Australia in the last year. They've just blown away the whole thing. Their government has installed, high powered bandwidth that, Andrew's over there getting 100 down for the same price we are for 35 down. So at some point it's going to have to break.
Well, and that's a good point, because competition, being Fios being a competition, will make things change. Without being forced to, they won't do it.
Yeah.
We need good competition for sure.
Because you need a choice. Like where I'm at, my choice is my cable company or even worse, DSL, and that's it. There's not much of a choice there. And I live in an Atlanta area, so it's not like a minor market. I live in a major market, and it's really, that's my choice. Those two. I would love to have a Fios choice.
Sure.
Yeah,
sure.
We don't have Fios either, Christian. So, it's that's got to roll out into more markets, and mm-hmm. we see Google really making a run at this with their rollout of gigabit everywhere, and so that'll put some pressure as they start moving into cities and say, okay, if you guys aren't willing to do it, we'll do it. We got billions of dollars behind it. We'll make it happen. And I think that'll begin to put some downward pressure on it. So. Be interesting to see. I think we've got some pretty cool stuff. I mean, what you're talking about here, pretty cool that you're able to do this. You're on the East Coast. Yeah, you have Fios at home. Yeah, you got a dad who, you got a subsonic administrator at home that is probably one of the most knowledgeable guys in all of subsonic, in that entire infrastructure. So you got a lot of stuff going for you there. That's definitely not average guy stuff for the most part. But I think the average guy could set up, Gary and I had talked about subsonic at one point. I even had a subsonic server running here at my place. I don't any longer, just because I didn't have the time to keep it up, or work with it. But, you got some pretty good stuff rolling on there. So very cool. Let's move on a little bit.
It's average guy usage, not average guy setup.
Yeah. And you know what? It's probably average or above average tech guy setup. I don't consider myself the above average tech guy, and I was able to get it set up.
I think the music and stuff is pretty out of the box, but once you start getting into video and transcoding, and then my TV solution is me writing a bunch of scripts that I never really automated for public use yet. So
yeah, no, pretty cool. All right, speaking of public use, I want you to talk a little bit about, you and I have been going round and round with the averageguy.tv and some servers that it's set up on, and the averageguy.tv, we get a couple hundred hits a day, and it's not a big site, but you've learned a few things through the process. Talk about what you've learned as a host provider, which is basically what you are from.
Sure. So back August 20th, I started fighting the evil monster, inconsistently out of the blue. I have three VPS nodes all running CentOS, latest versions, everything's up to date, best customized scripts you can imagine for running the server. And the two were fine, but the one, the high-powered 8-core that runs BIOS mods and Average Guy and a couple other sites all in the same node started like inconsistently losing network connectivity, and it would go down for like a couple hours, then it would just show back up, and it would keep doing this thing, right? And the only way I could get it to stick itself back on the network was to keep rebooting the box remotely. So I'd be sending reboot commands, and that got really tiring. And so then I opened up a ticket with Verpus and said,
"You got sick of getting texts from me. Hey, Christian, it's down again."
Yeah, I was like, "Verpus, you need to fix this network."
At one point,
I
you were like,
"Tell
hey,
my
you
customers."
Want to do this?
Yeah, I'm like, either you guys are gonna fix your network, or I'm gonna tell my customers that I have to move them to another provider because you weren't willing to, you know, fix your own network. So, oh, blah 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 blah, and we've sent it to our ISP, and then they come back and they start telling me, your website's under attack. It's a DDoS. And I'm sitting here going, bullshit, because I can turn the website off in its entirety and it still goes on and offline, right? So I'm pretty PO'd at this point. I get the SLA refund credit for the month because it was just totally inexcusable. And then I start poking around, and eventually, as a stopgap measure to like keep the thing afloat, I installed Cloudflare over the VPS. So what Cloudflare basically is it's a, for people who don't know, it's a what's called the content distribution network, a CDN. And what that is essentially you have all these high-powered servers in different locations throughout the world, and the CDN basically copies content from your web server and farms it out across all the servers in the world. And that way, when someone hits your site, it gets the files that put together your website from the nearest server that you're located to. So your latency is a lot lower. In theory, your downloads are a lot faster and the site pops together a lot faster. And it's a load balanced solution, meaning that not everyone is hitting that VPS to pull data. It's getting it a mix from different CDNs and then some from the VPS. So really, Cloudflare acts as a layer over the VPS that any traffic that comes to your site has to get through Cloudflare before Cloud, and then Cloudflare is the only thing that can pull to and from the VPS, right? So in order to do that, I got that up and running, and surprisingly enough, the server kind of stabilized itself out around the same time, but I really wanted it online just so that, you know, kept the server from having issues. And that did a couple things for me. It helped with the load, even though load was not really an issue. It gave me some more uniform load and performance and consistency. I was concerned with it because it was a lot slower at first, but as people started to use the websites and the content was able to distribute across the Cloudflare network, it started to pick up. And I mean, just from a latency perspective, if I used to ping that VPS from home, it would be around 90 to 100 milliseconds, right? If I ping that same website from here with Cloudflare enabled, it's 5 milliseconds. So right there, you have 20-fold latency improvements. Now, 100 milliseconds is not a bad latency at all, but a 5-millisecond latency, that's virtually, you know, bam. And also, just to show you the importance of latency versus location, it was 100 milliseconds when I was up in Buffalo, but now that I'm sitting at an ISP in DC, it's only 50 milliseconds from that raw time, right? So location really has a big factor in latency, which is important in, you know, being able to deliver the content, right? So eventually they get back to replying to this ticket, and they're saying it's under DDoS, blah, blah, blah. And then they start feeding me this line about how I'm under a SYN flood, which basically SYN, which means, you know, these certain subnets of IPs are flooding the box, in which I replied, that's the Cloudflare network that I had to install because you guys stink at running your network, right? So I can either remove that and have you rerun the same test that show it's your network, or we can move on, right? So they go back and say, no, don't do that. Go to Cloudflare and under threat control, set the security level to I'm under attack, which basically means that whenever someone hits your website, it does this little pause thing for 3 seconds. It says Cloudflare is scanning your device to make sure that it's not malicious, right? And so I started getting some interesting results from that. Picked up a couple, you know, web bots and stuff, but it wasn't really anything. I mean, a couple spam IPs, but nothing that would have caused the network issues that we were having, right? So eventually, I started to look at operating system logs because I knew it really was nothing with the web server because I already had a pretty good blacklist of IPs on port 80. But what I didn't discover was that port 22 was getting hammered by China, the People's Republic of North Korea, and Brazil. And what port 22 is for any VPS is a... that is where your secure shell traffic takes place. So when you're in the Linux world, everything's happening through a command prompt, through shell, and through what's ultimately referred to as a terminal. And all that traffic takes place over port 22. So it's just like using a remote desktop, except it's a command line interface for Linux machines, right? And that port is how I get into the server and have network connectivity, right? So it was no wonder that when I would try an SSH in and it would freeze up and lock up, it was because some guy in Brazil was trying to brute force his way into the root user account. So there's these bots that sit out on the internet looking for open port 22s, and then they just start dictionary attacking the thing in the whole nine yards. And I had found several, I mean, not just Brazil, but there were a couple people in China doing the same thing all at once on the server over the course of like the last 2 weeks. Now, the interesting part is some of the dates that there was server problems, uptime, downtime, corresponded with the SSH attacks. But the first couple didn't. So I'm still going to blame those on Verpus. But then I think what started to transpire is after the initial whatever it was that Verpus screwed up at, the stuff that came later that I thought was still Verpus had to be this SSH stuff. So at first, my first approach was to say, I'm going to capture all the IP addresses that Cloudflare identified as malicious and that were trying to brute force their way into my server, which is another reason why you need a strong password, especially if it's a root account, and just blacklist those in the IP tables firewall, reboot, and fine. And believe it or not, as soon as I did that, it was quiet for maybe about 12 hours, and then guess what? A new IP address from China showed up trying to do the same thing again. So eventually I got really pissed off at certain XYZ countries, and so I decided to ultimately, my ultimate solution was to run a script that blocks entire countries. All the IP address ranges that belong to a particular country, I blocked. So I blocked all of China, I blocked all of North and South Korea, I blocked all of Brazil, all of Spain, all of Argentina, all of Indonesia, and I think there was one other one that was not on my happy list. And
not on now, your happy list. I like that.
Yeah. And when I say blocking those countries, I'm not blocking them from accessing the website on port 80, which is web traffic. I'm blocking them from accessing the administrative ports that allows them to start hitting that server and guessing at root passwords. So I basically just block countries that can't have access to those ports. This is a common...
Christian, wouldn't you want to just block every... So if you're the only one getting into that administrative port, wouldn't it be easier just to block everybody except the IPs you're coming from?
Yeah, ideally that would be the solution, except I'm on the move so much that my public IP is changing quite frequently, and so I would have to keep VPNing in back to my home network, setting in new IPs that change, and then being able to SSH in. So ideally, I would want to restrict it to USA only, but just blocking all the IP ranges in the countries that I listed previously was over 23,000 IP ranges that I had to add to an entry that took about 15 minutes for the server to process and add. So to do that for all countries except the U.S. would probably take at least a couple days and would suck up way too much CPU.
Sure.
Because you have to block it by ranges. There's nothing magical in the Linux kernel that looks up an IP's location and then blocks or denies it. I mean, I could write a script for it, but it would take some time, right?
Sure.
So this was kind of the... I basically just picked the places where there's consistent threats from with these types of bots
and
dealt with it that way. I used to have a script that would notify me whenever someone logged into the server, which was good in case someone who wasn't supposed to be logging in did, but it's really not useful when... it doesn't tell you failed attempts, which I could have modified the script to do failed attempts, but the original mail server I was sending out that was a Gmail that once I enabled two-factor authentication, changed the whole password thing, and then that thing stopped working too. So really this was kind of the best solution.
Sure.
This is normally in the sysadmin world, the other big example is when people leave their MySQL port open for database access, which is port 3306. Now, for me, that's an example where the only IPs that I have to allow access to that port are the web servers that need to access it. So no one can try and brute force that port unless they gain access to the web server that's actually serving web pages, which is only two other IPs, right? So, and that's your ideal situation of lockdown and control. So by default, my firewall says block all these ports except for, you know, your port 80, your 443, your 22, etc. And then in my case, the custom solution for this was, you know, block the countries that are giving you a hard time. So once I kind of got that in place, I had Average Guy on DDoS protection from Cloudflare. I took Tag entirely off of Cloudflare because it wasn't really getting enough concurrent hits to warrant needing a CDN. So I, you know, it's actually faster in that situation for it to just access the VPS directly and return it back. But I've left for now as an experiment. I've left Cloudflare enabled for BIOS mods because I've actually seen a really nice rebound in traffic ever since I've done that, which is surprising actually. But because BIOS mods gets a lot of worldwide traffic, so I actually would imagine that it's very plausible that that CDN is doing a better time serving the overseas customers because there's a lot of servers in that Cloudflare has abroad. Yeah.
So. Well, and you get a lot, like you said, with BIOS mods, you get a lot of, you get a more global reach. You know, I think as I look, you know, we do about 2,500 to 3,000 hits a month at the Average Guy. So not, you know, not a ton. It's a great community. I appreciate you guys out there listening and hitting the site. We get way more traffic to the site, I think, from people finding us on Google than you guys going out. By the way, you, the listeners, going out to the site and hitting it. I've watched that over the course of a day, and man, I know I get some hits from places that we don't have listeners. So I know they're finding it. You know, we see the reference too that's in there. But you're right, Christian. We just don't have enough for a small little site like ours, or like mine, the Average Guy. That probably doesn't make sense. We can serve up that content. You know, we use YouTube for our video content. The audio stream is pretty easy to do. It works pretty well by not necessarily pushing that global.
Sure, yeah, and I mean the other thing too is like you have to remember that on Cloudflare actually tells you a lot of interesting things that you might not get directly out of Google Analytics, and one of the things it tells you is percent people versus percent crawlers and bots. And if I pull up the analytics right now, September 4th had a super rocket traffic day, and I think that's because of CDN, but in any case, I'll shut up about that. One of the pie charts shows regular traffic versus crawlers and bots, and BIOS mods gets 13% of its total page views is crawlers and bots, and you may think, well, what's going on there? In one day, Cloudflare has measured Google crawling 14,477 pages on BIOS mods. It's measured Bing at 11,577. So the difference between a site like Tag and a site like BIOS mods is that there are these internet harvesters like Google and Bing constantly crawling and indexing the site. So the performance has to be there all the time because the crawling happens all the time. Whereas and because BIOS mods is a dynamic content generator, that's why the crawling and the routines happen so often. Whereas a site like The Average Guy, where it's a much more targeted audience, location, etc., the crawling doesn't have to happen as often because we're publishing content. It's not as dynamic, right?
So we don't have forums. We don't generally have a lot of people making comments. So the data is not changing.
Sure. But like I said, and this has a really cool, one of the really cool tools that I think is useful for any system administrator to get used to that I got some additional exposure to through Cloudflare is something called Project Honeypot. Let's just define a honeypot first. So a honeypot is basically a dummy device that sits out on the internet and waits to get it hacked. So it has a certain set of programs, a certain set of rules and stuff, and it just waits for an IP address to try and hack into it, right? So it makes itself a walking target. And when that virus or that bot comes flying in there, that system captures everything it's doing to the system. And then on the website, right, so the website is called Project Honeypot, and what it does is it tells you how the IP visited, what it did, what the impact was, and how many times it saw the IP show up in other places on the internet. So it's really useful for determining, is this an IP I want on my network or should I be blocking it? So that was a really nice thing that I used, where when Cloudflare identified an IP as being challenged, which means that it basically did a security check, I could go in and cross-reference it with the Project Honeypot database and see, okay, this IP address is from Germany. It has a lot of email spam, so it's a mail server spammer, and it also says here that it's a dictionary attacker, meaning that it's going to be trying to brute force its way into anything that has a password field. But one also interesting thing that is a problem, right, is that IP addresses are constantly changing, and the owners of IP addresses constantly change. So the owner of a malicious hacker's IP could suddenly be released and renewed to a completely innocent person who wants to view your content. So one thing that's useful in Project Honeypot is it will tell you when it was first brought up on the network and when it was last kind of shown around. And there's a message that shows up on any record lookup that basically says, for ones that it applies to, this IP has not seen any suspicious activity within the last 3 months. This IP is most likely clean and trustworthy now. And now, remember, that's kind of a conditional message, right? So you have to say, why is this IP showing up on my, on my radar? You need to take some proactive steps into saying, is this IP doing legitimate traffic, or is this, descriptive of what showed up in the past? And if so, block it, but don't just block it and move on. You should also go back to that community page that had that information and submit a comment. It doesn't have to be long, but just submit a comment saying, this IP is still active and spamming, and that will let people know that it should still be on their block list. Ideally, like with port 80 blocks and stuff, your web application, if it blocks something, should also say, if you think this is in error, then, go here and contact to be requested and et cetera. But, sometimes you want hard blocks on, like, static spam IPs that you just know are not going to be given back to benevolent people who are interested in viewing your content. So.
All right. Well, we had that was, you learned a ton through that. That whole scenario, right? I mean, that kind of forced you.
Yeah,
into some quick learning.
It's not like it's anything, I guess, new for me so much as the fact that it was kind of a new response, because when people say DDoS, the typical thing is, oh, my site's down. But, I turned off the website and knew that I was still having problems. So it was really just the intuition and me not being so insular and thinking that port 80 was the only kind of route of avenue that made me a better sysadmin, and is really a part of why I'm here for cybersecurity at University of Maryland. Not just defensive, but learning how the offense takes place too, so that I can be a smarter.
Yeah,
smarter
it was ironic dude. How that happened. You get to school and then you're going through all this, cybersecurity stuff. And I thought we probably couldn't have planned that any better, even though we didn't plan it.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny too, because I mean, they have probably like 2,000 honeypots on the University of Maryland's network too for us to play with. So, I mean, it's nice. Doing honeypots is a characteristic component of defensive cybersecurity.
Yeah.
And also learning the offense, obviously. So.
No. From an average guy standpoint, I had set up, when we talk about honeypots, I had actually set up my own PC in the house here that was not connected to the network. That would have, I think I was running Windows 7 on it, maybe even Vista, I can't remember, it was a while back. And it would be the PC if ever I was working on someone's computer and I needed to plug a drive in for whatever reason, that was the PC I used. I'd fire it up and I'd plug it in just in case, right, that hard drive was infected with something or whatever, and it had a couple, I had about three different antivirus stuff, on it and some detection stuff. And it was just a really helpful tool. That's one of those tools to think about. If you're, you know, my PC support numbers have dropped with Windows 8. I'm just not even helping people with their computers anymore. I don't get the calls like I used. Yeah, it's really weird. It used to be I was helping people all the time, and now I get nothing. I get the occasional, I got infected, right? I still get that, and I just say, you just need to reinstall Windows, you know, at this point. But that had been a really helpful tool just to have that kind of honeypot, you know, in the background to use to make sure I wasn't throwing those drives on my systems.
Yeah. You know? Drash and Outer Chat makes a good point about any open port being a vulnerability, which is why it's always good never to open a port unless you need to. But I think what a lot of people don't realize is that, like, for example, if you have a shared web host, for example, that MySQL port is open to everyone because, like, for example, take IX Web Hosting, right? So they assign you on a shared platform where a bunch of customers are accessing that same server. They can't just block the port, right? They don't know what your home IP is, right? So that's a serious hole, right? So, but normally in a shared environment, you don't even look or monitor about that. That's the provider's responsibility, right?
Right.
But when you get to the VPS level, same thing kind of happens in the sense that the VPS provider will open kind of all the default ports that are actually, that's another lie. The VPS provider, the ISP, there's no firewall at the ISP level for your VPS. So it's on you to make sure that IP tables is up and blocking everything, which is what I do. But clearly, leaving port 22 open for the whales was dumb on my part. But I really, because I had done a lot of Windows administration probably 3-4 years ago. I mean, I didn't get into Linux web hosting until like 3 years ago. And so I wasn't clearly thinking about port 22 being a point of entry, which is, I know it sounds absurd, but
well, now you know.
Yeah.
I want to wrap this. I'm going to go step back a little bit because Mike and I went through an exercise when we were setting up our pfSense routers. And it was more an exercise for me. Mike was telling me what to do when we were setting this up. But Mike, remember inside pfSense, even in your own, at your home level, there are some blocks that you can put in, right? You can run some things to block various countries from coming. Talk a little bit about that because you walked me through that.
Yeah, so pfSense comes with what they call packages, and I'm running the older version. I think you're running a newer version, but both of them use packages. And I'm running a package called Country Block and IP Block List. So Country Block, you know, you can go in there, and I'm looking at it now, although I'm not showing you, but, you know, it's got top spammers, and it has Korea, China, India, Russia, Turkey, Vietnam, Ukraine, Brazil, Venezuela, and Pakistan. And I just block all those countries. It's just pfSense is just a, you click it, checkbox, and block all those countries. You can block more, too. You can block
That when you say block country. That means internally I can't go to sites that are hosted in those countries.
Yeah, I mean, basically it knows it's using IP ranges for those countries, and it's saying IP ranges from those countries you can't go to, and they can't come to you. It'll block them from coming into you. Also, which it's going to block anyway from a, you know, from a firewall standpoint.
Right.
Then there's another one called IP block list, and that one, I'm not sure if you're running that one, but that one's where you can get a block list from various places that is a listing that somebody has compiled of all these bad IP addresses, and you can load it into your into that package in pfSense, and now all those IP addresses are blocked.
And that's the those are some pretty current, the lists they suggest, those are some pretty current lists, right? I mean, Christian was saying, you know, IPs can drop and get reassigned, but somebody's kind of keeping track of that, right?
Right. You know, somebody's updating those. And there's a lot of them. There's a few of them that are very popular. If you go into the pfSense website, you can get, you know, or the forums, you can find out which ones those are. But, you know, I only have like one or two of them that are running that are more the more popular ones. And those work pretty well. You know, it keeps out all that junk. I have no reason to go to Korea and all those other places, so I just block them out.
A lot of times, not a necessary thing. That's a good for. So what Christian was doing at the server level, you know, you can do on a pfSense And there's been a lot of discussions over, not as much in the last couple months, but for a while, pfSense kind of picked up. We kind of go cyclical with pfSense in our community, right? It gets real popular for a while, and then a bunch of people implement one. There's a bunch of questions. Everybody gets theirs running. And it really is a set-it-and-forget-it router. I rarely even look at mine anymore. Every once in a while, something gets slow. I'll pull up the control panel and say, oh, what's the band? Who's using the bandwidth? You know, kind of deal.
Yeah. You know, I actually keep a, you know, I'm crazy with tabs and Chrome, and I keep two tabs open all the time for pfSense, where I can just go over to it and look at it, because I like knowing exactly how much bandwidth I'm using. Like, I'm knowing tonight that, you know, since I have HD video, I am pushing out
Rub it in. Just rub it in, okay?
Yeah, but there's a reason for me to bring it up. My out bandwidth right now is more than double what it normally is. So I'm starting to wonder if this HD out may cause some issues eventually. Yeah. But I'm pushing out, you know, 2.5 meg right now, where normally I would be, you know, one to maybe even less. If you look at yours right now, you're streaming, so you'd be higher.
Yeah. I'm a 3 in and 2 out.
See, I'm pushing more out, and all I'm doing is hanging out with you.
Okay.
But I can see that. I can see live statistics on what's going on, what's going out, what's going in. And, you know, I have two teenage boys, and if I see a lot going out, I can, you know, pfSense go and easily figure out who it was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I know some people, you know, when I first did this, people said, you're using a software firewall. And I said, all firewalls are software. Whether you bought it from Best Buy or you made it yourself, it's software.
Yeah, no, it's great. I love my pfSense. You know, we've got that dashboard we were talking pre-show about how long it's been running, and you hate to reboot this thing because it's got the stats on the last time it was, you know, rebooted. And I think in now we had a power outage a couple weeks ago, so I'm at 22 days, 10 hours, 32 minutes of my router being up. But it's gone.
What's that? Well, you had a power outage for how long?
Oh, no. It was for, an hour maybe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so everything went down. The UPS ran out of juice. And we lost everything at that point. But and everything rebooted. But I've seen that 60, 70, 80 days. I think you had it in the hundreds, right?
Oh, yeah, I had it in the hundreds. Almost made it for a full year.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so, right now I'm at 58 days.
Yeah, pretty cool to apply what Christian was talking about. You can apply this at home on their pfSense router. It's a little bit of above average tech guy stuff, but it's very, very doable. And lots of good information about a pfSense router. Now, did you wrote about the pfSense router, right, in the router article?
I did, and I intended for that to be a four-part article. And I don't want to get into it too deep, but I was going to do I was talking about how I set this up on a VM. Had it virtualized, had a pfSense virtualized. And I actually do what I call the super router, where I have pfSense the router and sitting in front of that, you're reading the chat.
Yeah, I am reading the chat. These guys will not give up on my video. It's hilarious.
It also teaches you, do you not have a UPS sitting on your router? Which, if you're off for several hours, okay, that's a UPS is not going to make it that far. But hopefully you do have a UPS sitting on your router.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, the UPS, I've got a pretty good UPS, but it's got the main PC and the broadcast server and the router all on it. And generally we get these quick little surge, you know, down and up. 99% of our downtime is that. I have some software I could go into it to tell me exactly when that outage happened and how long, what time and how long it was for. But it was longer. I don't know exactly. It was at least an hour, and my UPS is with everything running. Can't just with three PCs on. I just won't make it that long.
Well, you distracted me with something. I want to go down now, if you don't mind for a second.
Go ahead.
Talking about UPSs, you know, the new power supplies won't work with the normal UPSs that you buy. So the way I found that out is my home server, two of my servers, which I had to replace the power supplies, kept going off every now and then, and I was. You know, I was wondering, what is going on? Why are these things? I got them both on their own individual UPSs, and everything else in the rack is running, but these two things keep stopping. That's why I narrowed it down to it. They're using a new power supply, and it don't work with the UPSs. So I went to Micro Center this past weekend to get a power supply that they would work with, one that has a true sine wave. It took me forever to find one that actually said that, because most of them don't say that. Some of them you can see is simulated sine wave, but it's very difficult to find where it's written. And all I could find was a plain cardboard box that it had some other word to it that I figured out that that is the right kind. So if you have a UPS and you wonder why your system keeps shutting it off, even with the UPS on it, that's the problem.
Yeah.
Simulated sine wave.
We've had a lot of discussions, again, about 6 months ago. We kicked that around over in the forums over at the Home Server Show. We spent a lot of time talking about that. Even here on this show, we talked about
it. So it's given me, now I have a couple of UPSs that have nothing to do. So they are, like my router has its own UPS just for it. So it can last quite a while because it's not much hardware. It doesn't have a monitor or anything, so it can last a while. But on the Super Router, I actually have Untangle, which is another thing like you can use these individually. It's like pfSense. You can use it individually. But I have it sitting in front of pfSense to do virus scanning as stuff comes in and out and to do web blocking, web filtering.
Filtering, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
So you have some old hardware sitting around. Give it a try. Give a pfSense or Untangle a try.
Yeah, or even some new hardware that's super efficient. That would be the best. That you can get some new stuff, low powered CPU. I mean, I think right now my CPU is running at 4% on that box. I overpowered it. It's an Atom 525 and it's overpowered.
And one of your listeners emailed me when I was on last one. I talked about how we put Untangle in front of our email server at work, as handling millions of emails a month. And it is just running. It's Core i5 system, and it's probably i5 is overkill even for the millions of emails that it's handling.
Yeah.
And it's blocking spam very, very nicely. We're blocking hundreds of thousands of spam, a month with that system.
Yeah, and we've talked and we've said before, hey, old equipment, let me encourage you for power savings because this thing runs 24/7. Mm-hmm. Buy something, you can get something really inexpensive right now that's running the latest, especially, some of the latest stuff that's out there, and at least go easy on the power. And it just doesn't, not much RAM. I also put an SSD in there because I had it. It had a 30-gig SSD, so I threw that in there. I wasn't going to put a 30-gig SSD anywhere else in my systems anywhere, so I did that. Runs fine. It just keeps humming along. It's super quiet. Super quiet, super cool. It's been the best thing I've ever
done. You don't need an SSD. I found a use for what am I going to do with these 100-gig drives?
Yeah.
Well, there's a use for it. Yeah. That's 100-gig and a pfSense, that's even overkill.
Yeah, but with an Atom 525 and 4 gig of RAM and an SSD, the thing sips. I mean, it's a handful of watts when we plug it in and it's running. So it's a good way to do it. Well, guys, we have gone a good distance here. I want to start coming in for a landing. Christian, I know there was a few more things you want to talk about. So let me quickly run through a few things. We're going to save the Windows Server 2012 R2 Essentials. Redo for maybe the next show. We'll bring in. We'll talk a little bit more at length, just to give folks an idea what we're talking about. So a couple weeks ago, Christian was on the show, and he was talking about this awesome ability now within Windows Server 2012 Essentials to remote to actually connect. And I think you have your PC connected there, right, to your to the Essentials box back at home, and it's backing up, right? You don't have to be on the LAN to make that work, right? It has remote backup capabilities.
Right.
Right? So
qualify that, that's over. So Microsoft kind of condensed their routing remote access so that for the average guy, it automatically sets up the VPN that puts you inside the network to do that. But it's
working. You're in Maryland. You're backing up your PC to your... essentially your home server, which is a 2012 Essentials box right home. It works. You can do that. You don't have to be on the home network. That hasn't always worked easily or very well. It's working great for you. So you talked about that, and we just blew it off. Yep. We were like, okay, Christian. And I actually, if you go back to the last podcast, I actually apologize, and Christian and I had that conversation. I'm like, dude, I caught it because I was listening to the podcast to write the show notes, and I'm like, unbelievable. He had this whole, and I was chatting with the folks. I was in chat trying to, we were talking about why the high bandwidth and low bandwidth was working and why it wasn't. It's one of those things when you multitask during a podcast, you get a miss in the conversation. So a total miss on my part. So the very next week, Zadler is on the show. And John, so I bring that up, and John's like, oh, yeah, we got some things. So I think you and Zadler, Christian, were talking behind the scenes as well, because he referenced a moment when he talked to you, are you sure it can do this? And you said, absolutely. And so there's some capabilities that we didn't highlight very well. But I think just to make a long story short, you can now be anywhere. And of course, that first backup's going to be big. I think this was the lesson that we talked about last week. The very first backup's going to be pretty big. And if you have bandwidth caps, that may not be great.
Yeah, the ideal scenario is if you can get the first backup in at home and then take the device off-site to connect, then that's like your best deal.
Yeah,
that's
so
how I did it.
Take it to your home network, back it up one time, pick it off, take it where you're going. Do the rest of the backups remotely.
Because the incremental backups don't take that long over the Maryland network at all.
No, well, yeah, you're in a pretty good boat there. But still, for the average user, that would work out pretty well. So they've made that and the connector install a lot easier in the 2012 R2 Essentials, or in Essentials, because you're not on R2 yet. You're still just on Essentials, right?
No. Yeah.
Yep. So,
but
so
it'll be there in R2.
Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure. So some good stuff when we talk about Windows Home Server stuff. Some good stuff there, Christian. Sorry, I wasn't listening. I can't. I don't always miss whole conversations, but I miss that one completely. So good stuff there. So just to come around on that, and then any other small stuff, any housekeeping, Christian, you need to clean up?
Oh, I just want to make this the. Can I digress? BIOS talk for like two minutes.
Yeah, I'll do one. Go.
All right, my super fast one is before I left for College Park, I took a Nettle 3 box, and okay, by Nettle 3 box, I mean an HP computer that used to have a Phenom 1 CPU in it that used to only support Phenom 1 CPUs, and it was a Nettle 3 HP board that used to run the famous chipset of its time, the MCP61 chipset, which was like a super big fan. I was in like everything at certain points, laptops and desktops. I mean, HP, Dell, Acer, I mean, everything had an MCP61 and Enforce 430 in it in the probably 2008, 2009 time frame, right? And so we had when our media center, which I don't even think I talked about this, but our media center was the only thing on our network that didn't have a surge protector, and zap, there went the motherboard and CPU, or went the motherboard. The CPU on it was a Phenom 2, one of the low 65-watt Phenom 2s. And so I mean, obviously we scrapped the board for the Haswell. Oh, yeah, I did tell you guys about that because I told you about building the Haswell replacement. But I took that Phenom 2 CPU and I stuck it in this Nettle 3 lab motherboard that's only supposed to support Phenom 1. And then I did a world-class BIOS-mods.com BIOS update by taking a retail BIOS for a BioStar motherboard and flashing it onto this HP OEM board, and it detects and runs the 65-watt Phenom 2 perfect, and it's sitting in my dorm room running all my apps, and it's just it's a fantastic box to throw around for college that I don't have to worry about, and my flamethrower can stay at home comfortably.
That is a hack right there, my friend.
Yep.
Nice job.
Making use of the resources.
Yeah. No, it's very cool. That's one of the advantages of being the guy out there at bios-mods.com.
You got it.
Yeah, rock on. Mike, anything you want to wrap with?
No, I think I'm good.
Right. Good stuff. Thanks for coming out. And
I can always do some photography stuff out there, but I think we did good tonight.
Yeah, no, it's a good show. Christian did some good stuff. Just before showtime, Andrew said, I'm not going to be able to make it. And it's always, for me, it's always nice to have a second. You know, to have at least three of us. It could be Christian and I, but those aren't my favorite podcasts. It's more fun when it's three. And so I pinged you, and of course you're always great to just jump in at the last minute. So I appreciate your. It looks like the hair's growing out. By the way, you're getting that starting.
It is. If I turn just a little too much, you can see. I've noticed a few times because I'm on with you guys, but over to my right is where I'm watching the show live and watching chat. And if I turn a little too much, you can see a little bit. But it's the only thing that's weird about the hair being this short is if I run a comb through it, it just won't do anything.
Yeah,
I run a comb through it. It's right back where it started when I. So combing it is worthless.
You got a couple more weeks before you can comb that.
At least
I was going back and looking at some old podcasts, and you know how it's so funny. You can you see people as they are today, and I don't like I do, but I don't remember you with longer hair. You know, at this point, we've been looking at you so long, and I was like, wow, his hair was really long. It was longer, right?
Longer, we'll see what I look like when I come to the home service show. I may still have to wear one of these little blue yarmulke. One. My wife bought me a blue and a black one. I don't yarmulke. It's not a yarmulke. a black and a blue one, and I do not like the blue one, so I'm sure I'll have the black one.
All right. Well, good stuff. Well, I think you're the spot. I don't think anybody's
going to. Does the phrase full fauché apply here?
It might. Oh, Christian, speaking of the full fauché, He sent me an email, and he is challenging your Haswell experience. So
please.
We might have to do please. A Foshé Johnson smackdown.
It's sort of like the Zoolander with the dance. What did
we're
they do?
Have a dance off.
It wasn't a dance off. It was a what they do?
A dance fight. It was a dance fight.
Yeah.
The title of next week's podcast is going to be the Haswell dance off.
The Haswell dance fight. The two of you are gonna. We're gonna. Sweet. So I'm gonna put the two of you together. He is absolutely. And he listens to the show. He sent me an email. And he said he about fell out. He was driving and he about drove off the road, or something like that. When he heard you talking about your Haswell experience, he fought it. It was not easy. And I even asked you. I'm like, are you sure it was that easy for you? And you're like, oh yeah, piece of cake. It was great. So
slept perfect. I popped. You know, we popped it in. Put it in the box. It's fast. It goes from a sleep state to pulling live TV in maybe about 2.5 seconds from when you hit the power button on your Media Center remote, and it's just there. And like I said, the OS setup and everything was quick, and it's on the domain, and it's low power, high speed, high performance. And if you want the benchmarks, I send you the benchmarks.
Not his experience, and so he wants to do a dance fight.
Well, I think now I got to go watch Zoolander later tonight.
Oh, Zoolander is great.
Oh, I know. I've seen it before. That's why I had the reference. But now that we've – and Jam3 Ohio out there says
– Yeah, Jim McCarthy.
Zoolander rules. Now I need to go watch it again.
That is one of those movies I think gets funnier as it gets older. You know,
the first time I watched it, I thought, that's stupid. Yeah, but I like the two main stars in it. And I went back and watched it again and said, why do I think this is stupid? This movie is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, it gets better. It's one of those that just kind of grows on you. So
yeah.
It's a good nerd movie. So so we'll get that put together. Mike even offered to come on the show, and so we'll get it done and talk through Haswell. So good stuff. I'm sure Christian will hold his own. This will be awesome. Can't wait to get that done. Just a few short notes on my side. It's actually in pocket. I got a brand new Lumia 520 that came to me from Amazon yesterday. What's today? Thursday? Yeah, so it came to me yesterday in there, and running Windows Phone 8, and has been a dynamite. This is $99, no contract. Okay, so if you're thinking about, like, hey, I want to do a Windows Phone, but I'm currently tied into Android, and I don't want to go on a contract. Okay. $99, no contract. I literally bought this on Amazon, shipped it to me. I'm a Prime member, thanks to Mike Howard. I'm a Prime member. And shipped it to me for free, came the next day or 2 days later, whatever, and pulled it out of the box, fired up the phone, no contract, no nothing. Everything except the Here apps, the Nokia Here. So that's like Drive and some of the map stuff. They won't work without the SIM card, right? So, but everything else works, right? All the other apps work. Of course, I can't get phone calls on it, and I can't get text messages because I don't have a phone number at this point. But threw the SIM card in, fired it back up, all the rest of the apps work. And the beauty of the, and I've talked about this a million times before, the beauty of the Lumia software is that you don't need an internet, you don't need a live connection to make everything work. So if you're in your car and you're driving, the GPS and the nav stuff works. You can download the maps in advance, but all that stuff works just great. So, been a great little Windows phone for $100. I'm in business. I'm never going to make a phone call on this thing. I'm just going to continue to use it like a media player, and it kind of gets me into the Microsoft space. And now I can go on Surface Geeks and talk about this piece. I like it. $99.
Yeah, it looks
good. Smart little phone, you know.
Looks good.
And so pretty cool. That just came in. I'll be talking about that over the next couple weeks, and had a little chat with Mary Jo Foley a little bit on Twitter about that. And then this morning, Paul, I was going back and forth with a little bit, a couple tweets with Paul Thrott.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, it was Brian, Brian Mystic Geek, right? Uh-huh. Brian Burgess was, he and I were talking, because he just bought one too and has been blogging about it, and same deal. I think they're going to sell it $99. I think they can sell a crap load of these things.
Well, you know what they've needed to do, and they're starting to do it now, is they need something to separate themselves. And that the thing with the Lumia that was 41 megapixel camera, that separates themselves from everybody else. And now makes people look at it. Because if you don't have something, people are kind of locked into Android or iPhone to get them to, you know, stop their gaze at one of those two phones, you've got to do something to get people to look your way. And I think that the 41 megapixel, that's a good thing to do. It gets people to look your way. And if you have a cheaper, good phone like that, it gets people to look your way. Because if you're not, when you walk in there to get pick up a phone, you're going in, I want an iPhone or I want an Android phone. There's got to be some compelling reason for you to even look over at the Windows phone. And once you do, now you can make an informed decision of which one you want to buy.
Yeah.
And maybe once they can get people looking at their stuff, you'll start to see some of the market share numbers come up.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
Speaking of things we got.
Yeah.
So in the last week, 2 weeks, I've had 3 hard drives die. One of them was a Caviar Black 1.5 terabyte and 2 Seagate 1.5 terabyte drives. So today I got 4 2 terabyte Reds come in the mail. And I just got an email that my Chromecast is arriving September 10th. So 5 days.
Oh, it's on its way.
Yeah,
it's on its way. I'll predict you won't be super impressed with it at the start. Just does a few things, but there's new stuff coming for it. So yeah. It's pretty cool.
I've been doing so today, all day today and all day tomorrow. I've been at the Heartland Developer Conference here in Omaha.
We're doing some live podcasting. So if you're listening live tomorrow, if you got some time during work, put us on theaverageguy.tv/live. Put us on. I'll be doing about 8 interviews, all tech guys, all enterprise tech stuff. Although today I did an interview with a guy. We ended up talking for 20 minutes about Lumia, Nokia Lumia phones. He had the 1020, so I got a chance to see the 1020 in the wild and kind of look at it. That thing is light and slick and a big camera on the front of it. And, man, I tell you what, I'm liking what I'm seeing from Nokia and the Lumia line. I've said this before. If a Lumia was on Sprint, I would not have the GS4.
Yeah.
So it's I just like and having a Windows 8 phone or Windows Phone 8 at this point, I'm liking it a lot. It's a nice change from Android.
I think the fact that Microsoft bought or whatever that deal
is trying to buy.
I don't know if it's a true buy or whatever, but it sounds like it is. So I haven't looked into the deal. So if I said it wrong, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But you know, they're at least making a huge investment, if not outright buying Nokia, shows that they're committed to the Windows Phone and they're not giving up. You know, you can see BlackBerry looks more like they're giving up. And right now, BlackBerry still has a larger market share than Microsoft. So that tells you something, that BlackBerry sees the future is nothing but down.
Oh, yeah.
And no amount of effort to change that nothing but down, where Microsoft is saying we're still committed to this, and the BlackBerry going down may actually help them pick up market share.
I think so. I think a lot of BlackBerry users would probably come over.
And
so.
I think whether you're a fan of iPhone or Android phone or whatever, having a third competitor, strong competitor is nothing but good for consumers.
Yeah, no, I like it. We need 3 strong ones. And Microsoft's got the dollars, obviously kicking out $7 billion for a Nokia acquisition.
Yeah.
They've got some money. And you know what? This is how crazy this is, okay? They're buying them for $7 billion, all European money. So this isn't – they haven't even
– Is that real money, though?
That's real money.
That's monopoly stuff, right?
Well, no, it's real stuff. It's European. It's euros.
Well, they put that funny symbol in front of it. I thought that was like
they do.
Monopoly.
And I could, when I was in Germany and I had a bunch of euros in my hand, it is really hard to tell what is what when you've never seen a euro before.
Yeah.
So it took me a while to figure out their money, but $7 billion. It's all coming from the European division. That means they're not even touching the money they have here in the United States. So it's like, good God, they got money. So interesting. And then one last thing, I mentioned it early in the show, we got the Tech Scholarship Fund up and running. And so if you are an aspiring review artist, someone who likes to either write or come on the show and talk about some kind of tech gadget, this 520 would be something, although I've got one already, but this like this, you know, less than $100, some kind of consumer gadget that I can buy on Amazon, something that I can ship to you here in the United States. It gets difficult outside the U.S. for me to do that. But if you've got something in mind, let me know. podcast@theaverageguy.tv and let me know what you would like to do. And I'd love to talk with you about it. Maybe we can get it in your hands. You review it, you talk about it, you get to keep it. And it's just like that. I am done with trying to get reviews and get stuff out of companies. I don't want to do that anymore. If I'm gonna review it, if I'm gonna talk about it, I'm gonna buy it. And Leo has moved to that model and I like it. I hate begging companies for stuff. Although, speaking of that, we've got a whole bunch of stuff we're giving away at the meetup. You're going to want to be there if you're anywhere near Indianapolis on September 21st. You want to be at the meetup. I think everybody's going to walk away with something, Mike. I mean, I can't, except me and Dave. But I think...
I already know what I want.
I think everybody's going to walk away with something, for sure.
Isn't there some kind of... what's the big item? What's the big item?
Synology.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a Synology 415 or something like that, so... that they're giving
I'm bringing my truck so we can load it up in there.
Load it up and take it back. It's going to be a good time by all. Well, Christian, thanks for taking a few moments out of your schedule. I know life's crazy for you. You don't even look frazzled, dude. You've been in college for a week. Don't even look frazzled.
Nah, it's not as bad as everyone makes it out to be.
Okay, that's what I expect from you, Christian. Yeah, it's okay. It's only my freshman year of college.
We move, we adapt. It's the evolutionary cycle.
I like it. Mike, thanks for coming in on short notice. We are out here every Thursday night, 8 p.m. Central, even though I told Tim Black it was 8 p.m. Eastern earlier today on Twitter. It is 8 p.m. Central, 9 Eastern. And don't forget to join us an hour early on Grooveshark if you go out to theaverageguy.tv/music. We'll be messing around with that. I'm not sure we'll do that long term, but let's try it out for a couple shows and see how it works. So far, the reviews have been good. Everybody that's jumped in there has said, hey, this is kind of cool. Mike, it needs to run on a portrait portrait monitor.
And I have that on one of my monitors. Yeah, it's great on that monitor.
It is. It runs long ways. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to have to spin one of my monitors around if we're going to do it long term, or maybe get another one that I turn.
Yeah, I have four monitors here, and I have three of them in normal landscape mode and the one in portrait mode. And I've often thought, should I flip it back? But there's always something I'm saying, no, I'm glad I got that one that way.
Yeah, Grooveshark is one of those sites that looks better along, you know, like your social media, right? Like Skype, like Twitter, like all that stuff that runs long ways. And that works good. So, guys, thanks for coming out tonight. We'll do it again next week, next Thursday, out at theaverageguy.tv/live. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.